Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
This is Quality of Life, Valley Public Radio's look at the people and the issues affecting the way we live in the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Joe Moore.
Well, hello and welcome to Quality of Life. Central California is one of the fastest growing regions in the state. But with all of the development and population growth the Valley has seen in the past two decades, what unites our communities and makes us unique? Later in today's program, we'll talk with several local authors about our shared heritage and Valley history and how the past can inform our future. We'll also take time to read your letters on last week's program about drinking and driving. But first, we look at another issue that impacts the Valley in our ongoing series reporting on health. Californians spend $24 billion each year on diabetes care, according to statistics from the California Department of Public Health. For people struggling with the disease, the financial and emotional burdens of diabetes make for a difficult combination. When the cost of diabetes testing supplies add up, some bypass the pharmacy and turn to the street to get what they need. Correspondent Shelley Bronco has this report.
You can find a little bit of everything at the Fresno Fairgrounds SWAT Beat. There's tropical fruit and Latin music, skin whitening soap and medicinal herbs from Asia. Sometimes you can find diabetes test strips. Diabetes is an expensive disease. For the Valley's low-income diabetics, the price of medication isn't the only problem. Diabetes supplies are luxuries for those on a fixed income, but they're necessary to control the disease and prevent complications like amputations and blindness. Many turn to sources outside the pharmacy to get their supplies. Diabetics need syringes for the insulin that helps them digest carbohydrates. They need a meter to check their blood sugar, smaller needles to draw blood, and those thin, inch-long test strips that absorb blood into the meter. All of these supplies are purchased separately. A single test strip costs about $1, and diabetics test anywhere from 2 to 10 times per day. Add the expense of switching to a low-carb diet filled with fresh produce, and the experience can become financially and emotionally overwhelming. Maria Zapata knows what it's like. She's a diabetes educator for Central Valley Health Network in Fresno. She also has the disease.
I've been in denial for a long time, and even working and learning about it more, I began to accept it because I learned that I could control it.
Her experience inspired her to get involved in diabetes outreach. She works with many farm workers in the Hispanic community where diabetes is rampant.
When they're already struggling economically just to get something to eat and then having to get medications, their decision of supplies or eating.
Whenever possible, Zapata collects bottles of test strips to distribute to the needy. But she knows some struggling diabetics will turn to the street.
You know, the neighbor down the street, somebody passed away in their family that was diabetic, and they had a lot of supplies. And so they passed the word, I have diabetes supplies, do you know who needs them?
And the street isn't the only place to get supplies. Diabetics are turning to the internet to buy test strips. A web search reveals dozens of online companies specializing in buying and reselling diabetes supplies, from Craigslist postings to sites like WeBuyTestStrips.com. Internet resellers sell the strips at a significantly reduced price. Test strips are considered over-the-counter items, so it is legal to resell or trade them. But medical professionals are worried about the quality of test strips that are distributed outside clinics or pharmacies. Kevin Hamilton is the Deputy Chief of Programs for Clinica Sierra Vista. The nonprofit serves 25,000 low-income diabetics in Fresno and Kern counties. He says some patients will use expired test strips, or they'll treat them like pills and cut them in half.
Can you imagine somebody who's 60 or 70 or 80 years old sitting there trying to cut these things up and use them more sparingly so that they can get through 2 months instead of 1 month?
Community clinics like Clinica Sierra Vista work with pharmaceutical companies to provide free or low-cost supplies to diabetics. Hamilton says patients must maintain that personal connection to a primary care doctor to get affordable supplies and control the disease.
Quite often people get diagnosed and they never come back to the clinic. Even when we call them and say, you know, it really would be great for you to come back for your visit, they still fail to show. I don't know. I think it's out of fear quite often. It's a difficult thing to face.
Hamilton and other medical professionals like to say that if one person in a household has diabetes, then everyone in the family has it too. It takes that kind of support from relatives and the community for diabetics to take on the challenges of a life-altering disease. I'm Shelley Bronco.
And you're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Shelley, thanks for that report. You join us in the studio now. What are some of the problems, the other issues that Valley diabetics face right now in terms of getting care?
Among the Spanish-speaking farm workers, those with a limited education often have trouble reading educational materials for diabetes. So educators like Maria, who I mentioned in the report, they work one-on-one with them, each of them, to explain the diabetes routine. Also, when they're first diagnosed and a doctor gives them a meter, supplies, and all this information, it's so overwhelming that many just give up. And so diabetes education really takes time and a lot of persistence.
Well, thank you very much for that report today, Shelley. And we'd like to know what you think. If you have diabetes, how do you deal with the condition and deal with the cost of treatment, the testing supplies, and ensuring that you're monitoring your blood glucose levels? The phone number is 559-275-8989, toll-free 800-224-8989. You can also email us at talk@kvpr.org. We'd also like to know, have you ever purchased test strips online from a reseller or considered selling test strips online? We are joined right now on the telephone by a guest from the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. We have Dr. Allison Diamont with us today. Dr. Diamont, welcome to Quality of Life.
Good morning, Joe. Thank you so much for having me on the air. I appreciate the opportunity.
Diabetes is obviously a very big issue here in Central California. When one looks at the statistics of the disease throughout the state, inland California, the largely rural areas, including Fresno, Kern County, Tulare, Kings, all have some of the highest incidences of diabetes in the state. The numbers that I'm looking at here from a report that the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research released back in 2010, they date from 2007. Has there been any improvement in those numbers at all?
So, and I can say that I speak from both being a health services researcher as well as an internist, so I actually care for people that have diabetes as well. There is a 2009 California Health Interview Survey that was conducted in 2009 and 2010. We're looking for the results for that data pretty soon. Unfortunately, I don't think I'm very optimistic at this point in time. There have been programs, policies that have been put in place to help people understand the importance of controlling diabetes to reduce the complications, the health complications, the emotional complications, and the effect that it has on one's interaction with friends and family as well as one's job. But I don't think we've had those policies and programs in place long enough to see a change in what's been just this dramatic trend in an increase in obesity as well as diabetes over the last 30 years.
And these are obviously two issues that are tied very closely. Are you seeing, what is the explanation, at least in your professional opinion, that would give some light on this map that's rather dramatic? You have coastal areas in the Bay Area and Southern California have a much lower percentage of the population, in some cases less than 6%, or 6 to 7% of the population with diabetes, and in the Valley and other rural areas, you have 9% or more. What's the opinion as to why that geographic disparity is there in the state?
Which is a really, really important question. County by county, thinking about how to address this issue, how to help people as individuals, how to help the county and the state overall. We know that there's a lot that goes into why people develop different medical conditions. Some of it's genetic, some of it's family-related. A lot of it, though, has to do with our own individual characteristics. And I'm not talking about blaming anybody at all, but the opportunity to have more education, to have a higher income, to live in an environment where one actually has a choice about what to eat. If there are no supermarkets that have healthy food options nearby, then people may, by default, rely on fast food, for example.
Does that in and of itself then lead to looking at perhaps unconventional solutions rather than simply treating conditions, looking at more regional lifestyle sorts of issues to combat this?
Very much so. And I think, you know, I think it's a combination of things. It starts at home. It starts at work. It's a matter of city and community planning. It's a matter of county and state issues and national issues to some degree. But I think, you know, we want to take care of everybody in our own backyard. It's a matter of when urban planning gets done, making sure that we've got fruits and vegetables that are readily available and that fast food markets aren't taking up every corner of an intersection, that the food that's provided to kids in schools is healthy, that we're teaching the importance of eating healthfully both to kids and their parents. Literacy is a huge issue. California has a huge immigrant population from many, many countries, and people come to the United States with various understandings about health, their family history of medical conditions, and cultural variation in terms of what people eat. So we can't say, oh, everybody has to eat the same diet. We need to think in a respectful manner, but find healthy food options for everybody.
Is this a relatively new problem? Not the disease itself, but the disparity in its impact in certain parts of the state and its increasing impact in the population?
It is. I mean, certainly the overall population of California, as we know, has grown considerably over time, but the prevalence of obesity and diabetes has increased disproportionately. There have been significant changes in our lifestyles over the last 40 or 50 years. Part of that is spending more time commuting, living in a more sedentary society where people that have more voluntary time, where they can spend time either exercising outdoors or going to a gym, know that that's important. And other people who don't have those resources are very much limited. We know that there's a lot of processed food that's more available now than it was 40 or 50 years ago. And again, with resources that families and individuals have, it may be easier to feed a family of four by going to a fast food restaurant than purchasing all of the raw ingredients, spending the time to cook. And so we need to think about how our resources are distributed and how we can address these issues from multiple perspectives. And so that is the individual. It is the family learning about what's important, but it's those people that are responsible and have an impact on the environment, making sure there are venues for physical activity in neighborhoods, that it's safe to walk at night so that people can get more physical activity, so that families can be active together and eat healthfully together.
We're talking about diabetes today on Quality of Life. Our guest on the telephone is Dr. Allison Diamant. She is an associate professor at the UCLA School of Medicine and an associate at the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. We would like to know what you think. If you have diabetes, how do you deal with the condition? How do you deal with the cost of the disease in terms of monitoring your blood sugar levels with testing supplies? That's a significant issue for many people. We have, we'll go to the phones now and talk to Dave in Selma. Dave, you're on Quality of Life.
Hi, thanks a lot. I'm a type 1 diabetic, and I have been for 47 years. Mm-hmm. I've read over 40 books on the subject, and the most recent one I read is a book by Dan Hurley, H-U-R-L-E-Y, called Diabetes Rising. And what it does, it indicates that we are indeed in an epidemic. And diabetes, even type 1, I'm required to take insulin, can be controlled with a balance between diet, exercise, and in my case, insulin. most of the epidemic proportions of diabetes are now related to obesity. And the older you are, the better the chance is that you'll get type 2 diabetes if you're obese. Type 1 diabetes is generally described or ascribed to people who are younger. I first encountered it when I was 24, and that is normally always insulin dependent. The costs of diabetes are astronomical. If you watch any TV at all, you'll see people willing to give you free blood glucose meters. What they're doing is giving you a meter so that you can buy their strips, their Accucheck or BD or whatever brand of strip.
And Dave, how do you deal with that, with the cost of those strips? As I know, that's a significant cost.
Well, I'm very fortunate in that I don't want to reveal the source, but I do not buy them off email. I do not get them illegally or anything like that. But I will say that if any diabetic maintains a balance between diet, medicine, and exercise, he or she will not be required to test as much. The person most responsible for the management of diabetes is the diabetic.
Well, Dave, thank you very much for your call on our program today. We have other calls to move on to. But
Go ahead. I just wanted to make sure that people understand that they are responsible for their diabetes, and there's many ways to control it besides testing six times a day.
Thank you for that call, Dave.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio, and this is our discussion on diabetes. We have on the line from UCLA's Center for Health Policy Research, Dr. Allison Diamant. And Dr. Diamant, one of the issues that came up in our report is the prevalence of these sites that on the internet, and whether it's at swap meets or at Craigslist or other avenues, where individuals are selling their unexpired diabetes test strips, at least hopefully unexpired, and then also purchasing them at a significant cost savings versus the traditional retail outlets. Number one, is this something that you've seen before, and does this raise concerns from a health policy perspective in terms of ensuring that people have the proper means to test themselves accurately?
Certainly it is, because I think the quality control is very, very important. Using strips inappropriately, cutting them in half, if they're not kept at the right temperature, so if they're exposed to either extremes of heat or cold, can make them not accurate. And that's a huge issue. The caller, the gentleman that called in, Dave, has a very, very good point, though, which is that when one has diabetes and you are on insulin, and so the vast majority of people that do have diabetes are type 2, which means that for the most part they've developed it in adulthood, although we have an increase in the development of type 2 diabetes among adolescents and young adults, which is really very, very concerning for the growing epidemic. But when one is on oral medications, one does not need to test regularly. But what is extremely important is being seen by your doctor on a regular basis so you can get the appropriate blood tests to monitor how well your diabetes is controlled, as well as other testing to try and avoid any of the complications associated with diabetes, getting your eyes examined every year, getting a urine test and following your kidney function, making sure that your cholesterol and your blood pressure are well controlled so that you reduce the risk of having heart attacks, strokes, or developing kidney failure. And so while it is very important for individuals to take ownership of having this medical condition, extremely important to have a doctor or a health venue, a clinic, where you can go and get regular care for diabetes, because if it is controlled, you can reduce the comorbidities. But I think we want to take a step even before that, which is, yes, if somebody has it, we have to take care of it, but how do we prevent it? And a lot of that is eating healthfully and exercising as well. And that's really important for our adolescents and our young adults, and even as we get older as well.
Again, we're talking about diabetes today on Quality of Life, and those of you in our audience today who may have diabetes, we'd like to hear from you. How do you deal with the condition? How do you deal with the cost of test supplies and maintaining a healthy lifestyle? The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. Dr. Diamant, another issue that's come up is the issue between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Is there a stigma, a social stigma associated with this disease at all? And is that another part of the overall equation that we have to overcome in terms of dealing with this public health issue?
I think that in different cultures, there are different beliefs about diabetes. And I think overall, we as individuals would much prefer not to be ill, and there is a connotation of a disease, of having a medical condition like this. Type 1 certainly is perceived as not within one's control. It's you've lost the genetic lottery, unfortunately. Very rarely, young adults and even older adults can develop type 1 diabetes, but for the most part, it is diagnosed sometime in childhood or adolescence. Type 2 diabetes is perceived more as having to do with personal behaviors and personal actions, although there is a genetic component to it as well. So it's not all about being obese, but obesity certainly is a significant risk factor and predictor for it. There are people who aren't heavy that develop type 2 diabetes for a number of different reasons. One's pancreas can fail due to other medications, or alcohol can damage the pancreas, and there are certain other less common conditions. But I think that close association between obesity, and I think as a society we do tend to blame people for being obese, and diabetes is a very close one.
You're one of the co-authors of this report, Obesity and Diabetes, Two Growing Epidemics in California. It came out in August of last year. Are there any success stories out there, maybe outside of California, other areas that have had a very serious problem with this disease and have made strides and seen improvement, whether through those larger societal lifestyle types of issues or treating the condition? Is there hope that California can turn this epidemic around?
Well, I do think that there's hope that we can turn it around. And I think, you know, a program and a show like this, in terms of letting people know about it, letting them know that they're not alone, that there is a lot of help that's available. There are very local success stories. But overall, we're seeing increases in diabetes across the demographic spectrum. So people, even amongst people at higher income levels, higher education levels, the prevalence of diabetes continues to rise, but at a slower rate. The American Diabetes Association, for people who do have access to online, and that could be at home or at work or at a public library, the ADA has an extensive list of menu options across lots of different cultures in terms of eating healthfully. And a lot of these recommendations are important in general for maintaining a healthy lifestyle, not just preventing diabetes or controlling diabetes, but preventing and controlling things like hypertension, which is very, very prevalent, and heart disease. I'm sorry, I think we might have just had an earthquake here in Los Angeles.
Goodness. I hope everything is okay. If you need to take cover, please do so. We're talking about diabetes today on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Dr. Allison Diamont is our guest from the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research and an associate professor at the UCLA School of Medicine. We will take a break and be back in just a moment. We will talk about local history and also read some letters from last week's program about DUIs. That's coming up in just a moment on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio, and we are talking about local history and its impact on our lives today. We'll get to that in just a moment. But first, I want to take a moment and read a letter from last week's program. We did an episode or a segment of the program on drinking and driving, and had a guest from Mothers Against Drunk Driving and also the CHP talking about the dangers of such actions. And we had an email from Parlin in Fresno, and he says, one of the root causes of the DUI problem is the anti-alcohol hysteria in this country, fueled by the religions which attach drinking as a theological issue. Their influences have traditionally run deep in American society since colonial times. Children should be taught how to drink properly in the home so that the forbidden fruit aspect of alcohol is removed. That is why the Clovis bus incident of alcohol in the water bottles occurred. Alcohol had been forbidden, so it was cool to provide it. Well, Parlin, thank you for that email. We got it after the program. That would have been a very interesting perspective to bring up during that segment, but it sounds like fuel for a future topic for another time. And again, you can email us on any topic. Our email address is talk@kvpr.org. As I said in our intro, the Valley is one of the fastest growing regions in the state. We've seen massive population growth, development growth here in the Valley, great waves of immigration. It's a great part of our tradition. But what ties us together? What makes the Valley the Valley? We're here today with several local authors and historians to talk about how the past shapes us today and can inform our future. Joining us in studio right now, we have Janice Stevens, a local author, and also Bill Seacrest Sr., local historian and author. Welcome to Quality of Life today. The Valley is a very unique place. It's unlike anywhere else in California, Central California overall. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what makes the Valley unique in terms of forming our identity as a place. And Janice, I'll start with you.
Well, I go back to the first book that we did, which was Fresno's Architectural Past. We did two volumes of that. And it started with my friend Pat Hunter, who we collaborated together on these books. She was commissioned by McDonald's restaurant down Divisadero and Blackstone to have local history paintings from downtown Fresno. We kept hearing about people going down there to see the paintings and then touring the downtown area to see the actual buildings. So we came up with the idea of why not do a book? And we discovered in that process that people want their history. They want to know what these buildings are and how they connect to our past. And to me, it's in the stories. It's in the stories that connect us with our histories. That's what we discovered with those books.
Now, Bill, one of the reasons that we're here today in Fresno or in Bakersfield or other places throughout the Valley, it ties back into our history. Fresno is a railroad town. The Valley is shaped by its past, and the fact that we're here, settled where we are, is such a part of our future. Are the various communities in the Valley still frontier towns in some way, in your opinion, as they were back in the 1870s?
To a certain extent, I suppose they are. Especially the little farm towns around the valley, that's a different type of city, municipality, or whatever they are. Yeah, very much so. Fresno, California is particularly unique history-wise because it was settled by Spaniards and Indians who mixed together and got the Californios, developed the Californios, native-born races here in California, mixed races. And so they have a particular, particularly interesting racial situation. It's particularly interesting now because California's population is, you know, becoming more and more minority, minority majority type of thing, and it's making for an interesting history mix. Just that aspect of our history is changing constantly because of that now, but it's very interesting. I forgot what your question was again.
That's fine. It's a very very interesting. You can go in any direction on these topics. Yeah. And if you have any questions or thoughts on the Valley's past as it informs our future, and you can call us at 559-275-8989 or toll free 800-224-8989. Also talk at kvpr.org. And Janice, turning back to you, this interest in our past, in these old buildings, or maybe things that aren't even around anymore, things that were torn down years ago, what do you think drives that, especially in a community when so many of us are newcomers and are from other places?
I think it's the sense of connection that you come back to these old buildings and somebody has a story, a remembrance of being in the buildings like the Security Bank building and some of those, the Helm building, Liberty Theater, all of these old buildings, Warner's Theater, going down and hearing that old organ, seeing that organ come from the floor up. Those things connect people. And newcomers, I consider myself a relatively newcomer. I've been here about 30 years. And I think getting involved in the community, I want to know what's around the corner. What is the history of that piece? And being involved in Heritage Fresno and serving on the Landmark and Records Commission, it's all part of discovery and discovering how that connects us from yesterday to today and our future. Our children need to know this.
Bill, I alluded to this in my first question to you, but so many of the Valley towns, especially those founded along Highway 99, so many of them owe their start to the railroad. Give us a brief rundown of why we are where we are, in whether it's Merced or in Fresno or Tulare, these communities that sprung up along the railroad.
It's where they established depots for the railroad. Where they established depots, that's where the town went up. And that building they built from you know, the Bay Area down to South Valley area. And eventually reached L.A. with it. But that was the driving force. Wherever they put a railroad depot, and they selected it. Fresno was selected by Leland Stanford, one of the railroad directors, because they were growing huge fields of wheat here at the time. They first arrived on the site, and they thought, what's that, all that over there? And they said, that's so-and-so's wheat field. And that's what kind of instant. And the settling here, that's what happened in all the towns, I suspect, where the water was good or the scenery, who knows. I'm not that familiar with it, but that's how the towns got settled, though. Well, the depots went up the town to build around them.
It's a little different, though, than many other communities in other parts, maybe communities that were founded earlier along the ocean or along navigable rivers. We're sort of...
Or gold mining rivers.
Yes, that as well.
Yeah. That's where Millerton, the first settlement here in this area was Millerton down the San Joaquin River. And, of course, as soon as the depot was built in Fresno, they tore down half the buildings in Millerton and moved them to the new site here.
That's something that happened a lot. The county seats and these moved around a lot in the various valley counties. And you have many communities that could have been the seat and could have been big metropolises, but now faded into history.
Yeah.
Right.
That's right.
Well, in doing Remembering the California Missions, which came out last year, it was all about the water. When the missionaries established the missions, sometimes they relocated a mission based on flooding or based on the availability of the water. So, and then the railroads popped up once these little communities started, and it all became those thriving little metropolises after that.
Yeah.
Do you think it's interesting, considering what we just talked about with the railroad, that now here in the 21st century we're once again talking about the railroad, mm-hmm. in this case high-speed rail, as having a potentially transformative impact on the valley and the future of our communities? Is that one of those aspects of history coming around again full circle?
I think it's going to bypass history. It's going to be so high speed, high rail that people aren't going to stop and linger over history anymore. When you take the 99 or the 101 or the Highway 1, you go through these communities and you stop and you linger and you explore and you discover. But high speed rail is going to be point A to point B and nothing in between, I think.
That's a good point. Oh, yeah.
We're talking about Valley history on Quality of Life today, and if you have any questions for our guests, you can call us at 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. We're talking with Janice Stevens, a local author. She's done a number of books with local artist Pat Hunter, celebrating the Valley's architectural history, also the California Missions and others. And we have local historian and author Bill Seacrest Sr., one of the most respected local historians in Central California, also joining us in our studio today. And we're talking about the Valley's past and present. One of the things that is a continual thread in history in this part of California is the immigrant populations, the folks who come here to work the land, seeking a new start, seeking something different, whether it's those who came here for gold in the 1850s and had maybe checkered backgrounds or looking for a fresh mm-hmm. start, or those who came afterwards seeking land and an opportunity to farm and raise a family in the California sun, to today's immigrants, whether from Central America or from Southeast Asia or beyond. How do you see those various groups that have come through California and this part of the valley?
It's an interesting parallel today with the past, because when the Mexicans first came to California, well, the Spaniards came here, established a culture with the Indians and so forth, the missions and all that. But during Gold Rush days, we had a lot of influx of Mexicans into the area, flooding the gold mines, because Mexico was a poor state then, like it is kind of now. But it was the same situation we have now. They had all kinds of Mexicans flooding in there, and miners and ranchers, and doing all that sort of thing. Perfectly honest, legal people, exactly the same sort of situation. Some of them, like the Murrieta brothers and some of these others in the very early days, were turned into bandits for one reason or another. Exactly like what's happening here today with a lot of our illegals. So there's a real parallel to be drawn there. I talked to a Mexican fellow not too long ago, and he castigated me for several of my books are about stagecoach robbers and outlaws and that sort of thing. And one of the books was called "Great California Stagecoach Robbers" or something. I forget the exact title, but a Mexican fellow cornered me one day in the library, and he said, "How come you're telling us about all these Mexican bandits and so forth?" And I said, "I'm not. If you read the whole book, you'll see there was just as many white outlaws as there was Mexicans, and for the same reasons." So a lot of things don't really change all that much sometimes.
Janice, how do you think that threat of immigration and new populations that may have on the surface little in common, but when you look deeper, there's a lot of similarities, whether it's looking at the Armenian immigrants who came here after the genocide, after World War I, to the Hmong who came here after the Vietnam War.
Right.
How do you think that shapes us as a people, as a collective part of the valley? How do you think that shapes our identity?
I think it's the similarities that we have. We're all basically immigrants. Not too many of us can claim that we're Native American Indians. So when you look at that, there has to be some sort of commonality that brings us together, and you start exploring some of these things, and that idea of those similarities comes together. I think that's why the sense of community is so important, that we need to be able to ground ourselves in our community and be able to have those connections. I was thinking, Bill, earlier when you talked about the Californios, when we were at the LA Festival of Books a couple of weeks ago, we met a man who was in that organization and was traced his lines clear back to being part of this early settlers here in Alta, California at that time. And I was thinking Native American Daughters, the same thing. We form these organizations to establish that continuity for ourselves and make those connections. We don't want to feel isolated from each other. We're a human being that humans like to be social and be together, and that offers us that opportunity.
Now, I understand you are participating in an event that's coming up shortly, talking about local history at the Woodward Park Library in Fresno. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, that's going to be really an exciting thing. I catch Kathy Rehart's pieces on KMJ early in the morning. I catch that sometimes and love her Valley Legends and Legacies. She will be there. So I'm looking forward to this discussion with all of us. And I see you mentioned earlier the Armenian history. We did William Saroyan Places and Time and established a relationship with the Armenians as a result of that book. And so I'm really looking forward to this. It's going to be an exciting event.
And when is this coming
up? This is Saturday from 1 to 3. It's my daughter's birthday, so we're going to be celebrating that as well. Happy birthday, Monica. So on May 21st, 1 to 3, Woodward Park Library.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Our guests in this segment have been Janice Stevens, local author, and Bill Sechrest Sr., also a local author and historian. We're talking about Valley history. We'll be back with a little more in just a moment here on Quality of Life, and we'll be joined by author Scott Morrison, also talking about the Valley's past. We'd like to hear from you. You can give us your comments. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Quality of Life comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore, and we are now joined by author Scott Morrison, another local historian. He is the author of the books Murder in the Garden, Volume 1 and 2. Scott, welcome to Quality of Life today.
Thank you.
Tell us a little more about what you have worked on in these books. Murder in the Garden. The garden, I assume, being the Garden of the Sun here in the Valley?
Correct. I worked for the Sheriff's Department for about 30 years, and I came across a bunch of older stories and started writing them for my union newspaper.
Have things changed that much in the Valley? We hear about crime today, sensationalized on the news. Has it really changed? Was it always this way, perhaps?
There's always been crime in the Valley, and violent crime.
Was this the Wild West, the lawless frontier?
Definitely was.
We have a caller on the line right now. I'd like to bring on Obi from Wonder Valley. You're on Quality of Life today. Welcome to our program.
Hi, thanks for having me on. A couple of questions. One, regarding the crime. Here in Wonder Valley, we have a mountain right in front of us here called Dalton Mountain, and kind of a nice history of it. Apparently the Dalton gang made a stand up there against the Santa Fe Railroad Sheriff and the Fresno Posse and came down to skirted around them and stole horses from the Elwood Ranch and rode on into Clovis. And that was many years ago. But my question is, do any of you know how Wonder Valley got its name? You know, it's the oldest dude ranch in California, but how did the valley get the name Wonder Valley?
Well,
I don't know that one either.
Thank you for that call, OB. That's a very interesting question. A lot of small communities popped up in the lower foothill areas. Was that perhaps one of those that emerged early on?
I believe Wonder Valley is a fairly new name for mm-hmm. that valley. I don't believe it was called Wonder Valley.
Probably when the Dude Ranch was established there.
I think so. I think the name probably appeared in the 30s or 40s. Before that, in one of my books, I have a story of a murder that actually occurred there, but they called it Squaw Valley, which is the next larger valley to the south of Wonder Valley. But I'm not sure that it had a name before it was called Wonder Valley.
Again, if you have any questions for our local historians and authors, so you can call us at 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989, also online at talk@kvpr.org. And turning back to Scott now, what are some of the particular or your particular favorites, stories from your books, Murder in the Garden, any that stand out and perhaps still speak to us today?
In the book, I went after the more interesting cases. There's been lots of murders, but the case in Wonder Valley, there was a murder there in about 1914. There was an Indian medicine man that lived in Wonder Valley, and he had unsuccessfully treated the children of another Indian. And the father of the children who both died thought that the medicine man was angry at him because he hadn't paid him enough money. So he ended up dispatching the medicine man for putting a hex on his family. Rather interesting case. It took the sheriff about a year to solve it because nobody was talking, but eventually they solved the case and sent the guy to San Quentin for a year.
Is there a – obviously, these are very fascinating stories. They read like something out of a Western novel. Is there a danger, though, in romanticizing our history and in our early years here in the Valley or perhaps reading it through the lens of Hollywood in any – aspect? I'd be curious.
I don't think we're doing that at all.
I don't see it as romanticizing. Generally, the crime back then probably had a less brutal turn to it, but there were brutal crimes. Today's somehow, and maybe it's because we're experiencing it ourselves, today's somehow seem more brutal.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Again, we're talking about local history, and we'd like to hear your thoughts or questions for our authors. The phone number here at the station is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989 or online at talk@kvpr.org. Scott Morrison and Bill Sechrest Sr. are our guests right now in the studio. And we've certainly in the past few years been in one of the periodic economic downturns that we so often have. The Valley has experienced great booms and busts over the years. You look at many of the buildings that were built in Fresno, Merced, Visalia, Bakersfield, right before the stock market crash, the Great Depression, you saw big booms. And then we saw big busts as well with the Depression and other up and down cycles. Is that a part of the Valley's, the continual history of the Valley, do you think?
Sure. Oh, sure. Those things down through time just keep reoccurring, depending a lot of times on different circumstances. But, yeah, it's always going on. It's part of life.
But the Valley, most of these communities, some such as Visalia, you know, predate others such as Fresno, Bakersfield also as well. But in many cases, founded in the mid-1870s and by the turn of the century, we had rather established towns with electric lights and streetcars and things. This incredible boom that they experienced in those early years, does it in any way foreshadow the types of explosive growth that we've seen in the last few decades, you think?
I don't know about that, but I don't know if you make those kind of correlations, but certainly the circumstances, I guess, are kind of similar. The growth due to different types of things, but that's a difficult thing to say.
That's fine. Yeah. We have a call on the line now. Chuck joins us from Fresno. Chuck, you're on Quality of Life. I understand you have a question for Scott Morrison.
Right.
Go right ahead.
It's Morrison. Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah, okay. You said you were deputy sheriff for 30 years?
That's correct.
Well, then, you must have known that the deputy that came back from the war, he was a prisoner of war in Japan, and he came back to the town and he get his job back as deputy. And his first day back at the job, he walks into the office, and there was one of his prison guards in Japan working at a desk. Do you remember that, man?
Yeah, the fellow was named Harlan McFadden.
Yeah.
I don't think it was his first day back, but, yeah, eventually Mr. Kai started to work at the sheriff's department. He had been a young Japanese guy from Fresno who had the misfortune of being in school over there when the war started, and got stuck there, and eventually they assigned him to POW camps, and the two of them eventually were both deputy sheriffs.
Fascinating story. Chuck, thank you very much for that call.
How come you never hear about that one?
I couldn't tell you.
Well, Chuck, again, thank you very much for the call today on Quality of Life. Again, the phone lines are open. We have 275-8989, the phone number in the 559 area code, or toll-free 800-224-8989. Turning back to Scott, I asked our guests earlier, Bill and Janice, their views on the importance of how history can, from the past, can inform our view of the Valley and our community today and for the future. What do you think the importance is? Is it relevant, or are they just interesting stories?
Well, they are interesting stories, but knowing the history of an area, I think, makes you feel more a part of the area. If you blow into Fresno because you get a job here and you stick around for a couple of years and then you blow on out, then you're never really part of the community. But if you're here putting down roots and everything, it's interesting to know that certain things happened at certain places, or that there was that various things happened. One of the things when I do my research that I find, and I find it amazing, going through the old newspapers to see some of the people who performed here, the entertainers that performed here over the years. Lily Langtry appeared in Fresno, you know, world famous, and she appeared at the Barton Opera House in Fresno. Some of your older listeners will remember the actor Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. He was on 77 Sunset Strip and the FBI. His father was a world-famous violinist who played in Fresno frequently. John Philip Sousa would play here almost every year with his band. It's just amazing, the world-famous people, that Fresno was on their tour.
in this age of publishing going through a transition and people having shorter attention spans, seems like things are going more to the computers. Is there still a market for books on local history, and are you still able to attract people's attention with your research? Is that been a challenge, or is there still a strong audience who's looking for these types of books and reports?
I think it is a challenge. They have to know that they're there. There are less and less people reading books than there used to be. But they have to know the books are there. When they find out, usually there is good interest. But it's a matter of catching their attention and letting them know that that these kinds of books and that this kind of history does exist.
And turning to Bill, in your years of research and writing, have you seen a change at all? Is there more interest in local history or less? Is it more challenging to get young people interested in the tales of the valley's past than before? Or
it's hard to say. The first book I did called California Desperados, all about crime in California. Stage robbers and gunfighters and that sort of thing. That went through four printings the first year it came out. And none of my other books since then have done quite that good. Mm-hmm. We never knew exactly what it was that set off that thing, you know, to sell as well as it did, but. The interest is out there if you hit the just the right note on it, obviously. It's a tough racket sometimes.
Well, again, you have this event coming up Saturday at the Woodward Park Library in Fresno,
yep.
And the time is
1 o'clock,
1 p.m.
And it's a number of Valley history authors. And again, we thank both of you for joining us today in our studio. Scott Morrison, author of Murder in the Garden, Volumes 1 and 2, and Bill Sechrest, Sr., author of a number of books, including California Desperados and others. Thank you very much for joining us on our conversation about Valley history. Thank you.
Highly welcome.
That's just about all for this edition of Quality of Life. For audio engineer Marv Allen, for producer Tracy Sharman, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, and reporter Shelley Bronco, I'm Joe Moore. Remember, you can continue the conversation online. Visit our website, kvpr.org. Send us an email, talk@kvpr.org. And be sure to join us again next week as we continue our community discussion. It's Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio, KVPR Fresno, KPRX Bakersfield.
Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.